Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new feature we're calling the Motorsport Commentary, Behind the Scenes, March 2017. Much like a director's commentary on a DVD, we will run through every new issue of Motorsport and give you a little insight into what went into making it. We'll take you through the photography tricks, sourcing stories, design challenges, and much more. Now, for those regular podcast listeners, you will recognise a few sounds. We're in the boardroom, so there are some squeaky chairs, but what you hear is literally what you get. We're just sat around a table and chatting as we usually do. Today, I'm joined by features editor Simon Aaron, art editor Damon Cogman, deputy editor Joe Dunn, editor-at-large Gordon Cruikshank, and the editor himself, Nick Trott. It's like a royal flush, that, isn't it? Right, let's get started and straight into it. Damon, let's start at the front on the cover of the March edition, and there is a beautiful Alfa Romeo Tipo B P3. But all is not as it seems, is it?
How very dare you. It's pretty much almost completely different to how it was in the real life. As with most cover pictures, we have to retouch quite a lot of images to make them beautiful and to make them exciting and striking. So, because the front cover is always the advert for the magazine. It's always the thing that makes you buy the magazine, makes you want to pick it up. So you have to make it as striking and as visually exciting as you can. And that's not always the case at Blyton, because it's quite a flat, featureless place with not much going on. So what we had to do with this particular cover is take the original with Andrew driving that amazing Alfa. First thing you'll probably notice is he's sitting a little bit lower in the car than he would be normally. So Andrew's a tall fella. He's about 6'5". Tall fellow. So he sticks out quite a lot.
Because he has so many Haribos.
he kind of was sticking out a little bit too far. So we had to drop him down in the cockpit a little bit. And then obviously that allowed us to kind of make the most of the cover lines at the top. And then obviously you wanted a big dramatic sky. So with the cover lines of Dawn of the Grand Prix car, you want that kind of dawn of time kind of feeling going on. So we've got a cover that's been made of probably about three or four different images. The sky was from, I can't remember now, but a few years ago we did a lovely photo shoot with that sky, and then we used that sky and then tinged it with a little brown and a little bit of just warming up a little bit, and then sort of boosted the greens, boosted the reds, and sort of got it all working pretty beautifully.
Okay, so to give people a bit of insight, how many cover images do you look at on average for a new cover? Every issue of Motorsport, because it's not just one, is it?
No. There's quite a few. We have a process where we choose what we think are going to be the best images for the cover. We put those aside for a rainy day, and then we kind of do the feature. Then that kind of allows us to really expand on what we do on the cover. So over the course of the month, it kind of percolates. It kind of has a time on the wall. We sort of print them out. They go up on the wall. We kind of take them down again. We change our mind, and then a whole new story appears, and we completely switch around. But this one was from day one. This was always going to be on the cover because it's such an amazing car, such a striking image, and such an important car. So it was kind of always going to be. Even with all the stuff going on with Bernie.
I'll add to that as well. Going forward, we're going to be looking much more at commissioning our own photography for cover images, because it's great having a raft of images to choose from, but we're still kind of being reactive then. And I think obviously what we're going to try and do is just to be on top of the cover format way before we've even started to put anything on the page. The good thing that we had here from the photographer, Stuart Collins.
Well, Stuart, yeah.
Stuart's a great photographer. And this image leapt out straight away because it does reflect the fact that we've driven this car. Not many people have driven this car. Not many people with ability have driven this car. So that's why it's moving, you know. I know it sounds a very simple thing, but we're using moving shot because we drove the car. We had a static option, and the picture was really nice. It was very crisp. It showed all the details and everything. But it didn't really have the drama, did it? It just wasn't quite there. And the other thing we looked at, there was a slightly higher angle. So the Stuart took a shot probably more level with the Alpha batch. So if you're looking at the issue now, imagine if your point of view was probably a couple of foot higher than that. And that was quite nice because it showed the two Ferrari emblems, the shields on the side. And of course, if you have Ferrari shields and there's a red car and it's your cover and it's in your face, then... You know, I'm obviously thinking, well, there's more sale opportunity with that. People are going to be drawn to that. So we had this kind of debate, didn't we? Because the lower angle was way more dramatic. The higher angle showed the shields, you know. So we were kind of, what was it, an arm wrestle in the end?
I think I won.
You're bigger than I think ultimately, I have to say, I mean, for me, it's a real buzz to see that. It's my first cover. Ultimately, though, it was you guys. This feature had been commissioned by you guys before I started, and the shoe had been completed before I started. And it was nice to come along and to say, okay, well, let's really get an impactful first cover. But I'm really, really pleased with it.
I think it's a good one.
So your first issue and your first editorial. I think we're used to writing slightly shorter editorials, but being motorsport, we quadruple the usual length. And then give you all those bits to write about. So, obviously, as you mentioned just then, you came in a bit late for this issue, but your first editorial, you went off to WRC rounds. Tell us a bit about your editorial and why you're talking about the things you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm nuts about all forms of motorsport. I think, you know, like the rest of us, Formula One kind of dominates our thinking. But, you know, as a kid growing up, I was lucky my dad, you know, took me to pretty much everything, really. So I love rallying, I love Formula One. Rallying's obviously very topical at the moment. Rallying is entering a new era as well as Formula One is. The cars are much faster. The cars are faster because the promoters want more spectacle in the sport. And we know this is what's going to happen in Formula One in 2 months or so. So I thought, okay, I've got to go to the Monte. I need to see these cars in action and for the significance of... What's it going to mean to the person who's on the rally stage or the person who's reading this in motorsport that the cars are any quicker? Is it actually going to make any difference at all? Now, jury's out for me, to be honest. It was mega to go to the Monte and see the cars in action, but I don't necessarily think they were more spectacular. They were when the tarmac was dry and they were on the right tyres, and then it was quite something. They were really nuts. It's kind of like those European hill climb events you see where these things are screaming up the hill, then the cars looked amazing. But of course, when the grip was limited and the surface was slippery, there was drama, there was sliding, but we're not talking Mark II Escort levels of drama.
We're in danger here of getting Simon Aaron onto Mark II Escort.
Well, Tommy Mäkinen said, I interviewed Tommy, and he said the cars are set up to deliver the performance at a slight understeer moment. You know, and I must admit, my heart sank when I heard that. Shouldn't it be a rule in WRC that the cars have to deliver their optimum performance when they're at half a turn of oxygen? That should be the rule. So
the rules also mean that they should all be rear-wheel drive as well, and actually be Mark II
That sound you heard was a can of worms being opened. But to answer your question, I had to go to the Monte. I had to see this, and likewise, you know, as we had a planning meeting, if you're listening to this, we had a planning meeting the other day, and we all sat around and we were thinking, should we all go to Barcelona to see these cars for the first time? And I guess that's how I felt before the Monte. I had to go. Therefore, it was nice to be able to write about it, because Mark Hughes writes far more eloquently about Formula One than I do. So I thought I'd dive into rallying.
I just thought that there's an additional rule that the car should be about 6 foot off the ground at all times. I think
that's pod racing, isn't it? That's less levitation.
but I think that rear wheel drive, Mark, it all works.
Yeah, great. Well, let's move on to the month in pictures. Damon, I'm going to come to you first again, because this is sort of shapes and colours, this one, I would say.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a pot, obviously, that you kind of putting pictures in throughout the month, but this is done quite late in the day, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what we're trying to do is keep it as topical as we can, because obviously the magazine goes in pretty much the middle of the month, somewhere around there. We have to try and be as relevant as we can. So depending on when events are happening and depending on their importance, of course, I mean, this particular one, we've got an amazing picture of Dakar with Petter Hansel with a helicopter flying after him as our main opening shot. So that was obviously the main story at this time of the year. We actually find it trickier to find the images this time of the year just because of the nature of the events. They tend to be rallies or they tend to be sort of off-season things. As the months sort of tick by, it gets easier and easier through the summer, and then it gets harder again at the end of the year. But there's always something going on.
Tom, you probably disagree with the events not going on this time of year, wouldn't you?
I have been known to attend the old sort of sporting trial and club rally and things in December.
On Christmas Day, yeah.
Boxing Day Mallory is an absolute staple for me, except when you miss like your season pass and I went to Wimbledon Baggers instead and the one just gone. But no, I mean, it is. I mean, I'm quite often involved in discussions with Damon when we're looking at what we can put in month in pictures, because he's desperate to find something, and I usually know something which is completely immaterial and irrelevant to the core audience. But it is actually happening, which it does have in its strength. But it's, I mean, yeah, it is a tricky one at this time of year. I mean, you've got Australian V8s and things which are going on, but I think, to be honest, it's actually part of the fun is trying to find something interesting somewhere in the world at this time of the year.
Yeah.
Gordon, but talking about things happening on Christmas Day, am I right in thinking that Jenks used to tested an F1 car, a Lotus, on Christmas Day?
He once took out a Lotus on Christmas Day and drove it round the roads, reckoning there would be fewer police cars out and fewer other cars he'd get into trouble with. And he got away with it. He drove it all day. And I think it only broke down at the end when he went back to wherever it was he'd collected it from.
Is this in the archive?
It's in the archive.
Magazine,
yeah. So there you go. There's a plug. There we go. Right. That's all available at
Mental Magazine. .com/archive. And also, should we do that again?
As long as it's on someone else's license, I'm all for it.
You put your hand up.
I'll do it, absolutely. I might have to close some roads, but I would.
Unregistered racing cars.
Yeah, exactly. As a series.
We break the law.
You
better not tell the readers beforehand.
Yes. Definitely don't read on the A14 at 6 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day.
the Bernie story. Joe, it's come to you first, actually, because as part of this story, we wanted to get as many people's voices on Bernie as possible, but I think you had a few problems actually getting anyone to say anything bad about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was tricky finding people. Just going back one step, it was difficult in terms of the timing, because I think Bernie, we all knew that obviously the Liberty takeover was taking place. In fact, I think it had taken place the week before our press week. And we knew that Bernie's position was going to change, so we knew we were going to cover it and we were going to be doing some content around, you know, the end of Bernie's reign. But it sort of jumped up on the Monday of press week, where Bernie announced, I think, to a German magazine that he'd been deposed, which suddenly made the story much more live, and it really was the end of an era. So we had to think of it become a lot more definite than it was the week before. We had to find some people to really reflect on what his reign at the top meant. And despite lots of mutterings and, you know, it being kind of a lot of people saying previously that Bernie was a difficult man to deal with, and a lot of people held him responsible for a lot that was wrong with Formula One, actually getting them on the record to say anything negative at all was very, very difficult. I think it's probably a testament to sort of the loyalty people show to Bernie. Despite everything, a lot of people, certainly that I spoke to, and the voices that we have in the magazine, including Derek Warwick and Damon Hill, were actually pretty complimentary about him and said that he was a very a force for good in the final reckoning.
Well, there was one contributor who declined to comment, Ron Toranak, who course Bernie took over from when he bought Brabham, and they worked together for a short while, and Ron's comment was, "I don't think I'd better say anything."
This is where we stop the tape. Yeah, that's exactly what he really
I've written it down. It's in a brown paper envelope.
He was actually, we got in touch with him because he wrote into us, didn't he, saying that he was fit as a fiddle still a couple of months ago.
Yes, a couple of months ago.
When we'd reported that he hadn't made an appearance at Goodwood because Goodwood said it was through ill health. And he wrote to us from Australia saying, despite what Goodwood say, I'm actually in very fine health and go to the gym 3 times a week.
He's 92.
Is he really? I was just about to say, have we done a podcast? Should we do a podcast?
No, I think that's absolutely one for this.
Should we fly to Australia?
Yeah, that's...
Okay. Yeah. There's an Australian Grand Prix coming up, actually.
Yeah.
So, moving on to the sort of Mark Hughes F1 section, he's done a piece on the return of Alfa Romeo. This, for me, is, you know, always started, makes me think of Audi going to Formula 1, you know, that story that kind of cropped up every year. Alfa returning to Formula 1 is something that's reared its head a few times. Simon, there's obviously a little bit of truth in it, otherwise Mark wouldn't be writing about it. But what are your thoughts?
It's one of these romantic stories that crops up from time to time. But it's, I mean, Alfa has this fantastic sporting pedigree, but it won the first two Formula 1, the first two World Championships of Drivers in 1950 and 51 with cars that were kind of pre-war leftovers, you know, polished up a bit and better than anything else around the time. Since the 1951 Spanish Grand Prix, they haven't won a single Formula 1 race. It's been rubbish. they supplied engine in the 70s, had a few wins here and there, and their own team in the mid-80s, which again didn't really achieve a great deal. I mean, it's just a company with a fantastic sporting legacy. I'd love to see them back in Formula 1 if they were at the level they were in the early 50s.
When was the last time that Alfa were great then? Was it
early 50s? Nice. I mean, it was. I mean, obviously.
I think on the road car side as well, actually.
Well, hang on. I'm only 1992 Fiat.
Are we ever going to have one anyway?
You tried to make down the Fiat Pandas now for a mate.
Sorry, there is that.
They built fantastic engines in the 70s, but they were fantastic engines that got you within a couple of laps of the checkered flag and then broke quite often. They've not had any major success at all as a works team since the early 50s.
I spoke to Mark just before before he delivered some copy, and we're interested in the Alfa story because, you know, Marchionne had said maybe there's a place for an Alfa Romeo team in Formula One, and there was obviously an ulterior motive for it. And but then in the office we started to discuss the kind of the role of a B team and what do the new rules mean for B teams this year or non-factory teams. And it's clear that whenever there's any disruption, rule disruption in the sport, that there could be a strange, unusual result thrown up. And or even further down the line, new teams come along and take advantage of a rule change. But so we asked Mark to go into the concept of B teams, what they are, what they were. And I think this year as well, I'm prepared to put some money on one of the B teams or non-factory teams winning a race or three this year, actually, because the rules have been
thrown up. Get
your
wallet out there.
I'll
put 10 quid on Force India. Oh, hang on, who's driving Force India this year?
It's the one who's going to win a race.
Perez and Ocon.
Yeah.
Perez and Ocon. Well, Perez could sneak a win.
He could, and Ocon's better.
Okay, I'm going to take that bet then. 10
okay.
quid.
Right.
Okay, done.
Of course, India to win.
It is literally on record. Excellent. Okay, look, let's keep moving onto the Pat Simmons piece that Mark did, and in it Pat talks about sort of three of the biggest names over the last few decades in Formula One: Senna, Schumacher, and Alonso. And Pat is in a very unique position, isn't he? Because he's worked with these three massive names. There are others who have worked with greats in our sport, obviously Ross Brawn, but I don't think anyone that springs to mind who's worked so directly with three such big names in recent times. Simon, you'll probably correct me on this.
I'm just having a think, actually. I mean, Neil Oakley, who was the subject of a lunch with us, I mean, he engineered both Prost and Senna to world titles and has worked with a great many. I mean, he's been at McLaren working less directly because direct technical directors don't work as directly as race engineers used to with the drivers. But he's worked with Alonso, he's worked with Hamilton. In a slightly less direct way, plus Senna and Prost. So, I mean, yeah, there are others whose CV is pretty impressive.
Maybe Gordon Murray. I mean, Gordon Murray's worked with Niki Lauda, Nelson Piquet, Senna, Prost.
Yeah. I think one of the great things about Pat, part of the reason why we have him on so many podcasts. He's very eloquent for an engineer. I mean, I don't mean to be rude about engineers, but because they're so much more intelligent than I am, actually, when they speak normally, I can't understand what they're saying. But Pat puts things into English that I can understand, which is saying something. And is very eloquent with it. Same as Gordon Murray, actually. Gordon Murray is the same. But that's why I think this piece is so lovely, is because obviously Mark has a great turn of phrase, but it's, you know, Pat's quotes just very insightful.
When I was covering Formula One full time, it was always very striking. You'd have the Thursday press briefing with the drivers, all of whom were scared of their own shadow, wouldn't say anything even remotely controversial. Then on the Friday, you'd get the engineers. And if you had a bunch, you had Ross, you had Pat. You know, you had Flavio Briatore in there sometimes, Christian Horner, Martin Whitmarsh. You got far more interesting content from the engineers. They were genuinely riveting to listen to.
Yeah. Joey, am I right in saying there was actually quite a lot cut from this story?
Yeah, there was. I mean, Mark had a fantastic chat with Pat, and when he reported back on how much ground they'd covered, it struck us that there was. You know, almost too much to film just a single feature. So we've actually held some stuff back, and I think we're going to run something in April, which is just as good, if not more sort of revelatory, I think.
I still feel in many respects that I'm a reader of Motorsport, so the way I analyse Mark is that he's so brilliant at pulling information, relevant information out of people, and what he delivered after this story was so much that we just couldn't cope with it for one issue. But then it started to crystallise into another feature, and it was clear we couldn't do that feature justice unless we ran it in a subsequent issue. So we are taking that content and we are turning it into a bigger feature. And actually it's being discussed at the moment as potentially our next cover. So those discussions are underway. Damon needs to find an image that reflects this amazing story that Mark has extracted from Pat. And at the moment, I think we're probably 95% certain that we're going to go with that as the concept. So keep your... Yeah. I know this issue's only just gone on sale if you're listening to this in... What's the date today? In 4 to 5 weeks, so there'll be another issue which will be equally...
Even better.
Awesome. Yeah. But it's a definite watch this space thing. Yeah. It really is a good story.
But don't buy this issue, guys. Okay, well, so
I think just before you move on, just it probably bears just stressing really that point that is part of the thing with magazines. Sometimes it's not about what you do run, it's what you don't, and it's about how you focus a story. And sometimes, especially with someone like Mark, as Nick was saying, you get so much great stuff that you need to focus it on one particular element of a story, and that can mean holding something back. And that's the exercise we've done with this piece this month.
Damon, the Hall of Fame pages, we announce an exciting little development at the Hall of Fame, and that's that artist Tim Lazell is going to be painting a painting for us.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Tim's a guy that we've loved, and we'd all have a Tim Lazell original on our wall at home, I'm sure, in a heartbeat. His work's been around for a few years, and he's a hard and fast motorsport enthusiast. Whenever I've spoken to him, he's always mentioned his love of motorsport and his love of the magazine, so it was a natural choice, really. We've actually got a Tim Lazell original on our office wall. I'm sitting here looking up and down, which probably doesn't translate to
Moss and Jenks.
The Moss and Jenks 55 races on our wall as we speak. But Tim's going to be creating something original and one off for our Hall of Fame event. And it will be unveiled on the evening of the event. So we're looking forward very much to seeing that come together. Nick and myself have been mulling over old pictures of the event that we're talking about, which I don't agree.
We'll keep it close to our chest. Yes. We have a particular theme that we've been talking to Tim about, and it is really special. Mm. So special that I think there's probably going to be...
I just think there's going to be something else we can do with the painting after it's delivered. Hopefully there's a way we can offer it to motorsport readers in some way, but we'll work that out. But it is a topic that is blow your socks off, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And well, he's done some sketches already, which all look amazing already. So we can't wait.
Right, okay, so we now actually move into the section of columnists, old and new. A new one is Dario Franchitti. Certainly someone who's achieved a lot on track. Nick, how did this column come about? You've known him for many a year now.
Yeah, I have, and in my previous life as editor of Evo, Dario was one of the columnists, still is, I believe. So I've known Dario for a fair while. He's unique in the world of racing drivers because he has a genuine passion and an encyclopedic knowledge of past, of historical, of racing. And he's also not afraid to name heroes and name events and name situations that inspire him. I was talking to Gordon earlier on today, actually, that we don't hear so much of that from racing drivers anymore. So Dario's got this brilliant way of communicating the then and the now. And of course, you can't pick holes in it because Dario was quite a good racing driver.
He won a couple of things.
And of course, he lives, breathes it, and he was forced into retirement, as many people know. And I think that he's sort of moved into being a retired racing driver has enabled his sort of love of the past to kind of flourish, and he's becoming more eloquent and more erudite and more of a scholar of historical motorsport. And you know, and this is a guy who's, you know, in his 40s. You know, he's not somebody who's, you know, coming towards the end of their, you know, their time. So he's a cool guy.
If he wasn't a racing driver, he probably would have been a motorsport writer, wouldn't he? Or he would have been on the motorsport editorial team, knowing his kind of knowledge and passion for the sport.
Well, I think there's a lot in that, because when I did this over the phone with him, and there were quite a few complications about the timing, when I first got hold of him, he was in the pit lane at Daytona, about to go out on the track as the Grand Marshal. So he did say, not right in the phone. However, I interrupted his breakfast the next day, and he said to me that he had an idea for the structure of it, which was this idea, which those of you who have already read it will see, of going through the mental run-through all the way through, and then at the end saying, that's only the run-through, now we're about to do it for real. So he thought about the structure of it, and that is unusual. There are articulate drivers, but I've not come across someone who had thought about how it would read on the page. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he spoke so well that I had to do very little fiddling and reordering with it. I had mugged up on lots of quotes and other comments about Indy practice, just in case there were gaps or something to lead him with, but I didn't need to. He talked and I wrote it down, and he planned it, so it's really his story.
Is this going to be a regular thing? Are we going to get more of Dario?
I'd like to. I'd certainly like to. And he's expressed an interest in helping out more. Of course, he's the busiest man in the world. He's got amazing. He's always travelling. He commentates on Formula E. There's all sorts of stuff going on in his life, but he's always, in the past with me, he's always managed to find the time to do this because he enjoys it. You know, he enjoys communicating it, and a couple of times as well, he's joined me on tests in the past, and I have to say it's quite something when Dario turns up to a road test, especially if he's brought his own hot rod 911 along. So I'd like to think that we'll see more of Dario in print, but also we'll see more of Dario, in maybe, let's see if we can do some videos, maybe some podcasts, maybe there's other things that he can help us with, and yeah, let's see where it goes.
Moving on to sort of the next page or two, there's another new columnist, Richard Williams. He has written for Motorsport before, Joe, talk me through this one. I'm going to come to you, David, in a second, because I think this must be in the top five of features that are very difficult to find images for. When you go.
Well, Rich, I've been a huge admirer of Richard. I think we all have here for years. I mean, he's, as you say, he has written features for Motorsport before, but he's probably best known for his sports columns in The Guardian and The Observer. the chief sports writer for many years. And he's he knows a lot about the history of the sport, and he's very passionate about the sport, but he's got great knowledge of lots of other things as well. And he was editor of Melody Maker as well, and was instrumental in setting up Island Records. So he's a real kind of Renaissance man. And it was felt that, you know, he would offer a sort of a more kind of holistic take on motorsport, not just a very narrow field of knowledge. He's got a very broad field of knowledge. So we're delighted that he's happy to contribute some columns. And this one is a great one. And he came up with the idea of using the 70th anniversary since Enzo.
It's what became a car punk, really.
And sort of ran with it. And he typically kind of just segues into the idea that, you know, Ferrari without romance isn't Ferrari at all, and then sort of looks at the current state of the team. So it's a really nice sort of all-encompassing piece, and beautifully written, as you'd expect.
David, just before I come to you, Nick, you want to say?
Yeah, it's obviously Nigel Roebuck's no longer writing for us. He moved to another title, moved to Autosport last year, and one of the things that I had to look at very closely when I joined was how we would shape the front of the magazine and the voices and the columnists. And and Joe had been in conversation with Richard anyway, and it was obvious that Richard could offer something in the magazine that we were potentially going to miss. I think Nigel, in many ways, absolutely irreplaceable, but we had to look at areas where we could satisfy the reader who was enjoying Nigel's copy. And I think Richard has done a fantastic job, and I think Dario to that, and add Matt, and to add Mark, and I think we've got this fleet of quite extraordinary columnists, actually. Yeah. So, of course, everyone will miss Nigel, and I personally, I wish I'd had the chance to work with him, but hopefully the reader will realise that we've put a lot of effort into trying to ensure that the front end of the magazine and the columnists are of a suitable standard. Mm-hmm.
David, talking about a suitable standard, if I was an editor and saw these two images as the only images on such a wonderful piece, I'd be asking questions.
Damon, it's a fine warning.
I've had it for 3 weeks. You did not even bother. Right, so let me get this straight.
This is page 40, 41, if you would like to open your...
Just for those listening, there is a close-up of a Ferrari logo, and there's a headshot of Luca de Montezemolo.
Yeah, well, this, weirdly enough, trying to find a picture of Enzo Ferrari going out for his first run in 1947, I think it was. There's not many around. This thing was pre-digital, I think, just at that point.
just.
I think it was still a daguerreotype, I think, in that way. So it's always a little tricky. Trying to find, especially when you have a columnist that delves so deeply into a subject and kind of weaves his way around a subject so well. It is hard to kind of touch on find a touch point for an image. I grant you, it's an eclectic pair of images to go along with it, but that's the whole drama of the Ferrari story, though, surely. And what says Ferrari more than the badge? Come on.
Yeah,
they're looking at me every week at this point.
It's all going. It's all going.
I think the written warning still stands. Moving on from this feature here, we kind of move into the bulk of the cover feature, which is obviously the Alpha story. It's kind of been split up into, I guess, four main parts. There's obviously the story of the Alpha, which Paul Fernley writes. And then there's a lovely piece by Richard Williams again on the car that beat Hitler. There's the actual track test, and that's Andrew Frankel driving it, as we mentioned earlier. And then there's also a lovely cutaway of the anatomy of the Alpha. So just starting with the Alpha story, Gordon, you work with Paul Fernley for years and years, but in terms of a story like this, he's the man, isn't he, in terms of that knowledge and being able to dig out the right bits.
Paul has absorbed more information through all his years than anyone else I know, and he can lay his mental hands on it as well. So he could probably have written this story without any references, but I know that he also looked at all the right books and contacted the guru, which is Simon Moore, the man who knows more about 8C and 6C alphas than anyone else, I think. So Paul was the right person to do it, and it's full of detail. I know his struggle was to keep it down to the size requested. That's tough, and there's lots of information. Leaving some of it out is very hard.
I mean, Paul's never claimed to be a racing historian, but I think he knows more about racing history than any professional racing historian I know.
I think that's quite right.
It's really remarkable.
It's a bit daunting to work.
The Richard Williams, who's the car that beat Hitler, obviously the clues in the name. Damon, I know you wanted to sort of talk about this, the photos that you used.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the obviously, going back to what we said a few minutes ago, there's not a huge raft of images from that period, obviously. I think in all of the picture libraries and all the archives around the world, there's probably only enough pictures to film one or two hands of this event. There's very, very few. So they do tend to get used and recycled around. So what we tried to do with the one on the other side, showing the rather stern-looking SS general, is to sort of show Nuvolari in the context of that time. It's from a library called Top Photo, who are a great sort of archive library. They, with that image, that kind of conveys the whole drama between that sort of that time. But the action shot is obviously nice and grainy, and lots of drama in that shot with him leaning over. But yeah, there's not a huge amount to choose from. The quality wasn't brilliant, but I think it conveys exactly what happened on the day.
So you're able to find more images from 1935 than you were from 1947?
Yes.
He's tying himself up in knots.
Yeah. We've run into the Hitler problem before when we were in history.
That's a few others.
Probably 1939.
We were doing a feature on racing posters, and we selected one which was a Nazi poster with an enormous swastika in it, and we could only obtain it from an American photo library. And they sent across an image, and the swastika had disappeared. And it turns out that it's illegal to promote images with the swastika on in the States, and we had to get special permission to have the version with the swastika on it.
So, Dan, not only have you only found very few photos, you've also actually broken American laws. Yeah. Is that why there's a power? Right, should we move on then?
I think to give Joe credit for the car that beat Hiller. That's a crack.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah. It's probably worth just mentioning at this point how, you know, obviously, I think Motorsport, among many magazines as well, but Motorsport is known for clever headlines. And the number of hours that are spent in the office sometimes coming up with a single headline. Gordon, what is the sort of the record of memory? I think it's a week.
Certainly. I've seen in the old days, we could spend the whole afternoon mentally banging our heads together trying to work out a line. And it'll come to someone at 11 o'clock at night and will then ring up and say, got it.
they are not the work of the moment.
It might be worth just pause there just to maybe tell the listener how the actual story came together, because I think it was probably one of Nick's first meetings that he called when he started. And we had this, and the story started with a driver of the car. And we thought that was great, because it was a fantastic car. It was going up for auction later on in the month, so it'd be our last chance to do it. But Nick sort of sat us all down, and we all went through, said, well, and why is this car a potential cover? And we talked about its importance, the fact that it was one of the first single-seaters, the whole dawn of Grand Prix came out of that discussion. Then someone mentioned, that was also the car that won the German Grand Prix in 1935. And so it was like, well, so that was the car, that was the Jesse Owen moment, was it, for cars? And that got us everyone talking a little bit more, and then there was talk about doing a cutaway and actually explaining what the car was. And so over a kind of period of half an hour or so during that meeting between everyone here, we all kind of threw in ideas, and that's what built the original drive story into a cover story. It was a great exercise, and the whole package works really well together.
Joe's getting a pay rise.
Just thought I'd throw that one in there.
What's so great is I can really claim lots of credit for that, seeing as I wasn't even in the office that day.
No, you were on a beach, weren't you?
Yeah, exactly. So obviously, to the drive, we have talked about Andrew Frankel driving this car at Blyton. I think, just talking about Andrew, it is incredible the number of amazing cars that Andrew gets his bum into. And he's obviously a very trusted driver, otherwise he wouldn't get into the cars he gets into. Also, I always think he's very good at getting across the sense of what it's like to drive one of these. And he's not afraid of admitting that he is afraid or apprehensive or worried about a particular car. Because I think a lot of journalists, when they drive something like this, they concentrate too much on what it's like, what the handling's like, or what it's like on the limits. And I just think that's all a bit of rubbish. That's not what this.
Yeah, obviously in my previous life, the Evo, which was all about, you know, reviewing performance cars, the amount of times I would read a review of a car, and I'd been on the launch with the journalist who wrote the review, and the journalists are talking about things that just didn't happen, and not only didn't happen, they haven't got the skill to make happen. You know, now I'll temper it a little bit and say that in the UK we do have the best reviewers, car reviewers, So it's certainly not a common thing. But yes, there are moments when you wonder that the journalist is trying to express something that would have liked to have happened rather than something that did happen. And Andrew's got this tremendous honesty. And of course, the thing is, he's good. He can drive. He races. He's races some incredibly valuable cars and competes very well. It's interesting to hear you say that he's driven so many cars. He's actually, there's quite a few things that he hasn't driven because he just can't get in them.
That's very true.
So when next time Andrew comes in, we'll say, come on, we know all the stuff you have driven, but what sort of stuff haven't you driven? I mean, there's a couple of things that he's really, I'm sure he's considered actually like taking a couple of inches out of his feet just to try and drive them, because he's there's a couple of cars that he simply cannot drive. But he's loved. So, great story there. Yeah,
it's from one sort of era to a totally different one, and moving on to the magazine, we then get to the big format e-piece. I know the feelings amongst motorsport readers, and I don't think we're going to get into a debate about Formula E right now, because there's two camps, each have valid arguments. Joe, how did this feature come about, and why now?
Well, it's been bubbling away for a couple of months, and I think it really sort of started probably back in tail end of last year. I think it was October when Audi announced it was pulling out of WEC to concentrate on its electric motorsport programme. But prior to that, obviously, we had Jaguar getting involved. Mercedes had announced it was going to get involved as a major manufacturer. And we just felt that the time, it had reached tipping point, really, and that with these manufacturers on board, it really was time for people to take this new series seriously. And the idea really was to kind of take a kind of a health check, really, of the sport and look back on how it had started out and the fact that it was regarded as a bit of a gimmick 3 years ago when it started, but that now it had reached critical mass and really asked the question, should we start taking Formula E seriously? And Gary Watkins, who's brilliant on sports cars, and is very plugged into Formula E, if you'll forgive the pun. Knew it was, nice. was a great guy to do it. I do apologise. I shall get my
on that bombshell. Those of you out there thinking Formula E is cutting edge, then actually we've got something even more cutting edge just a few pages later, which is this sort of. It's not the first ever virtual race. There's been hundreds of thousands of virtual races via PlayStation video games. But this one is probably the most publicised, I would say. And there was this huge million-dollar virtual race to sit alongside the Formula E race. And we have done a piece on it by Nick Clark.
Yeah, by Darren Cox, who is the former head of Nismo. And he was the architect, I guess is the best word, for the GT Academy, which was the gamer to racer programme that was run by PlayStation and Nissan to turn a gamer into a racing driver. And they've had phenomenal success. Jan Ardenbrouwer, Lucas
Ordonez.
Yeah, some really proper races have come out of the programme that Darren founded a few years back. I wrestled over this because I'm fascinated by the phenomenon of e-racing, because it kind of makes us all feel uncomfortable. Those that love, the smell of a racing car and the sound of a V12 and all those other things, this is potentially a fork in the road where racing as we know it changes. And I think that, interestingly, since we went to press, I think, with this, Audi have announced that they're supporting an e-race team. So they pull out of Le Mans, and we don't get to see one of the most extraordinary MP1 cars ever made. I mean, if anyone's seen these kind of the models or the pictures of this car that will never race, yeah. But they invest in an E team, you start to think, okay, yes, they're saving some money, no doubt about it, but wow, they're taking it seriously. So, and I'd had a breakfast with Darren a few weeks ago, and we were talking about it, and my mind was increasingly blown by the scale of this. By the scale of e-racing, and Darren runs his own kind of e-racing team. I don't even know what you do when you run an e-racing team. I honestly don't. I don't know. We'll get him in one day and we'll discuss over a podcast. But the scale is amazing. So one of the biggest websites that focuses on e-racing has got 4 million uniques a month. 4 million uniques, which is off the scale. So it's no wonder that manufacturers are not only taking Formula E seriously, but they're taking e-racing seriously. So now is the time to put it in the mag. And I appreciate it might jar
with some of our readers, and because the concept of it is possibly it's the antithesis of what we know and love, but we can't ignore it because it is a phenomenon. Manufacturers are backing it, and the scale is extraordinary. So yeah, it's a nice piece, and Darren, I think, did a strong job.
And so I think I know actually why ID's gone into e-racing, and that's because, as you'll see in the photo, something that Damon pointed out, is that even though they're racing virtual races, they are wearing fireproof overalls. So ID can actually use their 2017 fireproof overalls in e-racing.
So
is that the only reason? That is the only reason, apparently. it's also worth mentioning, there's a little sidebar on there, and the fact that Verstappen, which many people will know, spends hours on a game and practicing up on circuits. Sorry.
Yeah, it's just reflecting the electronic reality sport throughout the whole of sport. I mean, now Premier League football teams are employing 18, 19-year-old kids to represent them at FIFA tournaments online. So it's, and they're being paid handsome salaries to play computer games.
Yeah,
professionally for a football team.
And oddly, it's becoming a spectator sport as well. Yeah. You know, so
there well, are, that is interesting. It's not my activity, but the people are watching it in big numbers.
Yeah, and Verstappen is likely. Darren, I think, is prepared to bet that Verstappen will never equal the number of virtual laps he's driven in the real world. So he's driven so many virtual laps that he will never in his career drive as many actual laps. So. It's a fascinating area, and obviously get in touch. We would like.
We want
your letters, your emails,
and I'll duck.
Who does want to get in touch, the email address is editorial@motorsportmagazine.com. So do write into us. We do read everything that comes in, and we do try and answer them all as well, which is largely thanks to Gordon, who gets through them all. I'm going to keep things moving on because we haven't got too long left. Lunch With, this was obviously a very important one, I think, because I haven't heard anything from JJ Leto for years. You know, he's been very quiet. Andrew tracked him down and has done lunch with him. Simon, he has been quiet for a long time, hasn't he? And this is the first big feature I've seen with him.
Yeah, well, obviously he had personal problems back in Finland, which led to him being in jail for a time. But he's always been a fairly low-key character anyway. I mean, he was on Finnish TV as a Formula One analyst up until he disappeared from public view. And as he says, as JJ says in the piece now, I mean, he has no mobile phone. Very, very few people have his number. He doesn't have an email address other than his wife's. I mean, he's just, for a guy who was such a high-profile figure for so many years when he was at the top of his game in motor racing, he has a remarkably low profile nowadays. It's a very interesting tale. Yeah.
And what an extraordinary driver as well. I mean, yeah. I know that in F1, you know, he was the early days of Schumacher, and Schumacher overshadowed everyone. It didn't matter
who
in F1. But he, you know, he had the task of being his teammate for a while, didn't he?
And then broke his back before he actually had a chance to drive properly. So, yeah. I mean, his F1 career kind of crumbled before it really got up to speed. But I mean, I was at Le Mans in 95. And when he was taking 20 odd seconds a lap out of the other McLarens in the rain in the morning, just extraordinary.
Isn't there a little piece in there that said the team manager said,
"Do you know it's raining?" Yeah, something along those lines.
Same with Dale's time, and he just kept hitting it. He didn't understand that he didn't have to hit it in the wet. That's what
it's. It's a fabulous read. I know I would say that, but it's a really good story for someone who's been away from the limelight for some time.
And how do you pronounce his name again, Simon?
Yuki Yavi Leto is the full version. Or JJ Leto here from Bedford.
Right, but on that bombshell, Simon, I'm going to come actually straight back to you. Yeah, we then come on to your Camaro piece, the heavy metal thunder. It's a car that people would have seen at the Goodwood members meeting, and they would have seen it in period as well.
I'm old enough to have seen it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure. I'm going to move on. what is the car and what's the story?
Well, it came about. Nick's predecessor, Damien, whom we all love to bits. You'll remember his desk in the office was, if you'd kind of recycled all the content and turned it back into trees, you could have done a new forest a couple of times over. But somewhere in the pile of papers, there was an email from Oliver Bryant, son of Graham, very well-known family in historic racing. And he'd mentioned that they were recreating Richard Lloyd's Chevrolet Camaro from 1975, and would we be, they had some pictures of the rebuild and would be interested in doing a story on it. So I went to chat to them last year at Silverstone, and people have funny views about continuation racing cars or replica racing cars, but I don't mind people driving replicas if they don't try and pretend it's something it's not. And the Bryants were very open about it. The Lloyd car was written off in the mid-70s, but they'd found a lot of the original parts that had been in a barn for 30, 40 years, just sitting there from the original car. So they bought a shell. They'd seen the members' meeting at Goodwood, seen the Stuart Graham replica, thought we'll do the Richard Lloyd one, bought a shell, found that all these bits of the original Lloyd car still existed, had them all cleaned up, assembled the whole thing, and off they went to Goodwood. They've had lots of near success at Goodwood in the past, pole positions, fastest laps, lead races, never actually won one. They went with the Camaro, barely prepared and having all sorts of teething problems in testing, hoping they might finish the race, and lo and behold, they won it. So the car that was least expected to bring them success at Goodwood brought them the first success. And it's just quite a nice thing. And it's a lovely car to look at, sounds good, and it was a real shame in the mid-70s when the Camaros were outlawed because they banned anything with more than 3 litres and took away some of the spectacle from saloon car racing. But it's back.
Yeah. Right, into the sort of the final few bits and pieces. The future of Silverstone. I'm sure that headline has appeared in motorsport many, many times over the years. But Joe, what's different about this one? Why are we talking about Silverstone again?
Well, it was sparked off really by a letter which was sent by John Grant, the chairman of the British Racing Drivers Club, which essentially runs Silverstone, to members saying that the club was having to seriously consider whether to activate a break clause in 2019, which would essentially mean that they would break with the current contract they have to host Formula One, the British Grand Prix. At the time, this was in December, and at the time, I think that a lot of people dismissed this email as sort of sabre-rattling, essentially the British Racing Driver Club trying to sort of force the hand of Bernie Ecclestone and say, look, you know, you're going to lose the race unless we get a better deal and can make more money from it. And it was sort of dismissed, really. But then we had a tip-off from a couple of people saying that actually this time they really were serious about it, and there was a growing body of sort of a consensus forming, really, that the race was just too expensive for Silverstone to host, and therefore the chances of losing the British Grand Prix were very, very real. So we started to look into it, and the more people we spoke to, some of them on the record, some of them off the record, the more it became clear that this really was a sort of serious risk. And so we've kind of done the piece, and that's actually where, on the cover, we also asked the question, does the British Grand Prix have to die in order to save Silverstone? And that's what it boils down to. And it's a very interesting story to work on, and very interesting, hopefully, a very interesting story to read. Obviously, the kind of buyout, Liberty's buyout, has changed the dynamic slightly. But I don't think it's changed it that much. I think that there's still going to be a battle royal between the new owners of Formula One and Silverstone over the race fees and whether, not just Silverstone, other race circuits as well, can make money out of Formula One. So it's an interesting piece.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's a fabulous story. I think Joe did a cracking job and spoke to all the right people. And it certainly feels, doesn't it, like we're going to hear a lot more of this over the next few months or so. And Liberty's plans on the record to certainly expand Formula One in America. Well, something's got to give. You know, if there's going to be a Miami, a California, a New York race, there's going to be more races in South America, maybe. Well, something's going to give. And none of us want it to be Silverstone, Spa, Monza. But the fact that Silverstone themselves, or the BRDCs themselves, have seemed to be considering a contingency makes the story very real. So
I think there's, we haven't heard the last of this, and I think the jury still very much is out.
Onto the sort of the second last feature, the piece on Ian Hutchinson that I did. I could give a little bit of background to this. Basically, I got an email from the publishers of Hutchie's new book called Miracle Man, which is absolutely worth a read, asking whether we'd like to interview him, and I said absolutely, we'd like to do a podcast with him. So there was a lot of toing and froing, and we thought we were doing a podcast with him on a certain day, at sort of midday, and then the night before, we got a call to say, no, it's all off, you can't make it. So it was a bit of a surprise, as we were all sitting at our desk at 9:30 in the morning, and Hutchie, the multiple Isle of Man TT winner, wandered into the office and asked where I was. So we were slightly taken aback, we obviously couldn't do the podcast because all the equipment wasn't here, and we didn't have the full team, we didn't have Matt, obviously. So Simon and I ended up sitting down with him and chatting through his recovery from one of the racing's kind of worst injuries in terms of actually coming back from and winning again. And it was fascinating. It would be tough to find a more modest racer out there, and what he has got through to win at the TT again is quite extraordinary. And it's a lovely interview because I just literally quote him, and he's great.
You know? Yeah, I'd say, I've met a few bike racers, not all that many, but he's one of the most engaging and unassuming interviewees I've encountered in 35 years in this job. Hmm.
So, David, we started with you. I think we should finish with you as well.
Okay.
Well, that's it. Right. Like we'll see you all next month. There is a feature that many of the regular readers will know called Private View. We've obviously taken the piss out of David not being able to find images for certain features, but in this feature, readers actually send in their own images. So there's really no excuse for David not to find images. What is the difference between if you were there, a private view, because they're all readers' photos, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, at the beginning of the mag, we have a feature called You Were There, which is pretty self-explanatory. But a private view often is when pictures are of a better quality and they show much more of an event or of a scene or of a time. So it's much more atmospheric, it's much more about the drivers and about the cars and about the scenery and a place in time, like that, I guess is the best way to put it. Kind of summed up by Sebo with a fag hanger, I was about to really, which don't tend to get too much of these days. We tend to kind of have a few pages here and there of these, but because it's Can-Am and because it's the pictures are so wonderful, then absolutely we gave it lots and lots of pages, threw lots of pages at it to make the most of it. We all kind of love Can-Am. We had a feature, we did an issue a few months ago, end of last year, so September last year, I think, with the Can-Am on the cover, with the McLaren on the front cover, and we sold really well and everyone really loved. So Can-Am endeared itself to our readers, I think, over and over again, and why not? Let's indulge.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good run through. We're trying to keep it under the hour, and we've literally only got a few seconds left. Thank you, everyone, for helping us through this. Nick, thank you very much. Joe, Simon, Gordon, and Damon. We will be doing this every month, so do send in questions or anything you want to know about the magazine, because we'll happily answer them. The March edition of Motorsport, which we've been talking about, is on sale now, and you can buy it at all major newsagents. And you can also buy it on the website, www.motorsportmagazine.com. Our podcast will be making a welcome return next week, and we are sitting down with Jody Scheckter, the 1979 Formula One world champion, at his house in London. We asked him to come to the office, but he's so tight on time, we're off to visit him at his home. So that'll be great fun, and that'll be online next week. We'll see you all then.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.